when we deployed into Thailand, there was 450 forensic staff who came from 36 different countries, and there was no leadership structure in place. You don't have an international org chart. The reason the Australians held the leadership positions was because we moved first. I think if you wait until you've got all of the answers to all of the questions, someone will beat you to it.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent magazine for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers and leaders. Each episode, we bring you behind-the-scenes coaching, news analysis, exclusive interviews, technology and more to help you list more, sell more and elevate your results. To subscribe to the magazine, visit eliteagent.com.au/subscribe.
Hey, hey, Samantha McLean from Elite Agent here and welcome to 2019. I hope you've all had a great break and you're recharged and ready for a fantastic year. And here at Elite Agent, we're going to do everything we can as usual to support you in keeping you up to speed with the market and helping you to achieve your goals, whatever they may be. And to kick it off, we're going to tackle the topic of motivation. My special guest this week is Peter Baines, who is an Order of Australia recipient, speaker, charity founder, board director, and leadership coach. So you might not have heard Peter's name before, but many of you will clearly remember where you were when the Bali bombings happened in 2002, or when the Boxing Day tsunami happened in Thailand in 2004. The response to both of these disasters was a huge undertaking, and it fell to those who were first on the ground, in many cases Australians, including Peter. In the case of Thailand, Peter had to quickly establish a leadership structure under extremely difficult circumstances that could cope with the recovery and identification of nearly 5,500 bodies, thousands more than 9/11, in the sun in a time of national mourning. It's hard to imagine and does put some perspective on the parallel perhaps in our world, which might simply be motivating a team to do something which is way less stressful. For example, picking up the phone more often. But in this podcast, Peter and I talk about motivating teams and leading with innovation, especially through times of uncertainty and even crisis, applying some of the lessons from Bali and Thailand, and including the role that culture and shared experiences can play in both types of situations. While there were many leadership lessons for Peter during his time in Thailand and working with the survivors of the tsunami, it was a group of 32 orphan children that prompted him to start the charity Hands Across the Water, which today supports hundreds of disadvantaged kids across Thailand by providing them with food, shelter, medication, and access to education. Some of you will be aware of this charity already and the upcoming digital live Ride for Life across Thailand that a bunch of agents are taking on with our good friend Steve Carroll in April this year. And we'll be tracking their progress as they travel 500 kilometres across Thailand on push bikes in Lycra beside Peter in the name of charity. So if you feel motivated to join the guys or even support some of them, we'll leave some sign-up links for you in the show notes. Meanwhile, as I said before, a very happy and prosperous new year to you all, and I hope you get some great leadership lessons from my chat with Peter Baines. All right, so welcome to the podcast, Peter Baines.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks so much for coming. And firstly, Happy New Year.
And to you and everyone listening.
Thanks very much. So some of our audience might have gotten to know you a little bit through the work that you've been doing with Steve Carroll and with Digital Live and the crew, and we'll come to that in a moment. But just for some of our listeners who might not have heard about the work that you've done over your career, which has included some amazing things like you're a real-life CSI. And you were heavily involved in the crisis management in the aftermath of both the Bali bombings and the Boxing Day tsunami. So how did you get into crisis management?
Yeah, sure. So I started in uniform in the police in New South Wales and quickly moved into the forensic area, so into crime scene investigation, so going to scenes of major crime and suicides and homicides and sexual assaults and, so as you say, that real CSI stuff. And that was before CSI was sexy. And that became, for want of a better word, that became my trade. And I spent 22 years with New South Wales Police, and 18 of those was in the Forensic Services Group. And I spent 10 years in Tamworth as a practitioner working in that area, travelling through the northwest of New South Wales. And And then moved back to Sydney as a detective inspector at the end of 2001. And then, of course, Bali occurred on the 12th of October, 2002. And I was deployed over there in the immediate aftermath as part of the disaster victim identification team. So we were there to identify the bodies, all of the 202 people who died, and send them home.
So you were called over from Australia to Bali?
Correct.
And how long were you there for?
At the time, we're only doing short rotations, so they're only a couple of weeks at a time. And I returned back to Australia. But at the time, in that Christmas period of 2002, 2003 in New South Wales, we had a really bad fire season. And then I was deployed onto what was called Strike Force Toronto. And I was coordinating the forensic response to all the bushfires because many of them are not, but a number of them are deliberately lit. And they might lead to the death of someone, which then becomes a homicide. So I was redeployed from Bali onto Strike Force Toronto.
Gosh. And then when the Boxing Day tsunami happened, then it was 2004?
Four, correct.
Then you were asked back again to manage that.
I think there was a number of reasons I was asked back. One was the position I held within New South Wales Police, within the Forensic Services, was quite senior at that time. And the experience that I'd already had in Bali, it just made sense that I would go over and be involved.
Does anything at all prepare you for something like that?
Oh, I think, Sam, you know, like if I think back to my first days in both Bali and Thailand, you know, Bali was a really different experience because that was a criminal act. And I recall with incredible clarity to today, standing inside the police crime scene tape outside the Sari Club. And there was a guy, a local Indonesian, who rode up on a motorbike, had his helmet on, had a backpack on, and just stood outside the crime scene tape. And that resembles the bomber that walked into Paddy's Bar. And we weren't wanted in Bali. There was death threats against us. There was bomb threats at the hotel where the police were staying, and we had to be escorted to and from different locations. We weren't allowed outside of the hotel. It was a really stressful time. And because of not just the work that we're doing, but the fact that we weren't wanted in the country and there were threats against our life, Thailand was a very different experience. That was a humanitarian response. But both of them and the scale of Thailand, like I remember sitting in Denpasar Airport, leaving Bali after the bombings and thinking, biggest job I'll ever be involved in. 2 years later, you're at something which is 10 times the size of what we had in Bali. And what prepares you is that death was a constant to us. You didn't work in the area in which we worked and not be exposed to death in some level on a weekly basis. And that was what we did. So turning up into Thailand, death wasn't new. The enormity was new. The challenge was new. But in some way, it was a real privilege to be there. Don't get me wrong. There was no one over there from the police that didn't want to be there. We felt privileged. You felt honoured. I felt incredibly honoured to be asked to lead the Australian team. So we felt lucky to be there.
You're now fairly well known in the area of leadership consulting and speaking. And I guess with your background in managing some of those crises, there's a lot of leaders out there who would say that motivating people is probably the hardest thing that they would ever need to do or that they need to do to be successful in business. When your job is to deal with death on that scale, how do you motivate a team?
I tell a story when I speak at conferences around motivating Thai soldiers, and you have to understand, you know, their conditions to understand the challenge of motivating them. Some of them had been working at this site where we had all the bodies stored in shipping containers, and some of them had been there for 6 months. They hadn't been home. They hadn't seen their families. Each day their work consisted of lifting bodies, which were frozen, off shelves, in body bags, putting them on trolleys and wheel them throughout the site. When they finished work of an afternoon, they then slept in a tent at the site. When we were there in August, it was between 38 and 43 degrees outside each day. They absolutely lost their motivation for their work. And how can you blame them? And as the leader at the site, I felt responsible because their lack of motivation contributed to a decline in the productivity of everyone at the site. Because without the efficient movement of the bodies throughout the site, it didn't matter how good everyone else was. And it became my job, my responsibility to turn the productivity around. So we brought into what was most important to them. We didn't have money to motivate them. We didn't have the type of things that you have in business. We couldn't give bonuses. We couldn't do something like that. But what was important to them was the national anthem of Thailand. And they would sing it at 8 o'clock each morning. So I asked my Australian team to learn to sing the Thai national anthem. And this morning, to their surprise, when they stood to sing the national anthem, the Australians, we stood next to them and sang the Thai national anthem in Thai. Did we sing it well? Hell no.
Yeah.
Did it matter? Absolutely not. Motivating people is about buying into what's important with them or to them with honesty and with integrity. If you try to compete and try to motivate people by way of monetary reward, I think that just takes you down a dark hole. You know, how can you continue to do it? Because if real estate agent A pays someone a higher commission or a bigger bonus and real estate agent B wants to compete, well, the only way they can do it, if they're basing it just on that, is to pay more. And all that does is send the principals broke.
I was going to ask you about that in a little bit, but I'm interested to know, I have one burning question for you with all of your leadership experience. Are leaders born or made?
Oh, look, I think there's leadership qualities in all of us. And I think that all of us in our own right exercise leadership every day. Some will enjoy the opportunity of stepping into those roles more than others. And there's scope there to develop people. And there's not a leader who's not learning. So I think they're the opportunity. And if the leader thinks that they're not continually developing, well, they're probably not a leader.
So we're at the start of 2019, and traditionally at the beginning of each new calendar year as humans, we kind of reflect on the last 12 months.
Set some goals for the next year, yeah?
Yeah, and reflect on our hopes and dreams and things like that. So if things didn't quite go the way that you wanted them to in 2018, how do you work out what to focus on in 2019 to make the most of the next 12 months?
I think it's about having, and this has served me well, working in the different areas that I have, leading the different teams that I have in some really challenging times. And I think it's having a real clarity of purpose about understanding why you do what you do. And I think it's important as a business. So the guys that are leading real estate agencies, employing people, and knowing what's the most important to them. Is it about what they stand for? Is it the culture within the business? Is it around how their prospective or current clients are treated? Is it around the net income that they bring in? And because you'll do things differently, and I'm not saying one's right or wrong, but it just helps you with those challenging times if you're clear around why you do what you do. And, you know, if there's a change in the market, if the property market cools and if things go backwards and getting listings is harder, well, then you need to understand what are the non-negotiables, what are the fundamental things that's most important to you as a business and then as an individual. And for me, it's been about providing answers. And through my policing career, when I turned up, if I got called out as a forensic investigator, it was never good news for a family. Because I only went there when things were bad. So what was my role there? It was to provide answers to that family. I wasn't able to take away their hurt and pain, but I was able to give them information. So when we're in Thailand and when we're dealing with bodies, when I'm carrying the bodies of children day in, day out, multiple times a day, when I stand there and unzip a body bag and look at the innocence in a child's face, when I move the hair out of their eyes and I say, I don't want to do this anymore. And you do that a couple of times a day and you go, get me out of here. If you have to stay, then you've got to understand why you're doing that. And for me, it was about providing answers. And you get to choose what that is. So for those that have had a hard 2018, you can't just decide that 2019 is going to have all the listings and sales that you want. But you can decide what's most important. And you can just structure your work around those values.
So you speak a lot on the topic of shared experiences and how that can bring teams together. And obviously, inspired by the work that you did in Thailand, you've formed an organization called Hands Across the Water. So what does Hands Across the Water do, and how does that help give other people shared experiences to motivate their teams?
I met a group of kids on my last rotation into Thailand, and they'd all lost their parents, they'd all lost their home, and they were living in a tent. And at the time, I thought, well, I can't change what's happened, but I can change what happens next for these kids. So I started a charity called Hands Across the Water. I thought, I'll give myself 12 months, see if I can raise some money. I had no idea how I was going to do it. I was still working full-time in the COPS, but I thought, well, let's just give it 12 months. Fast forward on 13 years since we started, we've raised now $25 million, and we've never spent a cent of donors' money on administration or fundraising. We run 7 properties all across Thailand. But importantly, what we do is we create a life of choice, not chance, for these kids. Big part of that is the number of kids that we've supported through university, the graduates that we've now got who have, but for Hands, but for the supporters, you know, their life would be so different. And the flow-on effect of that, Sam, is the kids that will come, the next generation from these kids will be so different because of the change. And I think the thing that we've done differently is that very early on, I didn't have a network to go to raise money. I was in the police, and my network, if I was thinking about raising money, didn't really exist.
Yeah.
We had to do something different. Because we came up with this bike ride that we started in 2009. And what I learned quickly was that if you create meaningful shared experiences, you'll build really deep engagement. So 2009, we ran our first ride. Now, however many years on, 10 years on, we're about to head over again. And I've done 24 of these rides now. And it's the cornerstone of what Hands Across the Water is about. And it creates opportunities for organisations and like Digital Live with Steve Carroll, who formed Digital Live, met me and Hands, and he said, love what that's about. I said to him, well, why don't you join me on one of these rides? He said, I'm going to do my own. And the reason that they're successful is because you take people away, you have a shared experience, and you'll build the depth of relationships you just can't get in a workplace. For principals that are out there thinking, how do I get closer to my team? It's not about a fancy meal. It's not about a bigger bonus. It's not about that. If you want a deeper engagement, if you want a tighter family unit, engineer shared experiences. You know, you create memories, you create these experiences which you just can't replicate.
Yeah, so it's all about the human connection.
Absolutely. And I got to tell you, Sam, there's nothing more leveling than everyone walking down to breakfast in Lycra. Because when you're on that bike, it doesn't matter whether you're the CEO, whether you're what your position is, because you're all equal. You've got the same bike. You've got the same road in front of you. You've got the same hill. You've got the same temperature. You've got the same resources. And you find people who start supporting one another that you might not interact with in your normal business.
I guess this really allows you to connect very deeply with the community that it's benefiting as well, doesn't it?
It does. But, you know, the reason for the success of it is because it's food for your soul.
Yeah, which is something we all lack a little bit.
You know, talk about, you know, the people listening to this podcast as agents and principals and property managers and whoever else might be, and you say, when was the last time? And this is a question I ask people. When was the last time you did something for yourself that was food for your soul? Mm. Not for your husband, not for your wife, not for your kids, not for the business, but for you. And this is what these rides create. We have riders come back year after year, not because of the kids in Thailand, not because of the communities that we support, not because of the charity. It's because of what they get out of it. I lead a number of these business rides with groups that come together. And just as an example, took a property development group from Victoria away a few years ago on that ride. So the ride was made up of accountants, financial planners, mortgage brokers, and these property developers. There was a guy there who was the branch manager of one of the Bendigo banks. He wrote 20% of his annual lending budget on that 5-day ride. The reason he wrote that business was because of the relationships he formed.
So when do you set off on this next ride with Steve?
Steve's ride's at the end of April.
Yeah.
And the Digital Live ride is 5 days, and they'll fly into a place called Nong Khai and ride from just south of Nong Khai down to this place called Ban Hom Hak. For 5 days, they'll ride through the Isan region of Thailand and down the banks of the Mekong River, country of Laos on one side, riding in Thailand, and which is stunning.
I'm sure that there's probably some people listening that are thinking, you know, like, I wouldn't mind doing that. That sounds like it would be an interesting journey. How fit do you have to be? Level with me? How?
Yeah, look, it's one of those things that the ride is different to, you know, there's plenty of corporate rides and plenty of agents across the country would have been involved in a corporate ride. And the trouble with them, and I've done some of them, is that they're more about how fast you can ride, how much your bike cost, and how quickly you can drop people. You know, our rides are inclusive experiences, and we ride on average 25 Ks at a time, and then we stop. And we have a water stop, and you fill up your water bottles, you have a coffee, you have some watermelon, you get on your bike and you ride again. Yeah. And you repeat it, and you repeat it 5 or 6 times a day. Now, during that 25 Ks, you can ride in the high 30 kilometre an hour average if you choose, which is pretty quick, or you can ride, you know, 16, 17 Ks an hour talking as you and I are right now. Next thing you pull up at the water stop, you go, geez, that went quick because we haven't stopped talking. The fitter you are, the more enjoyable they are. But you don't have to be out there in your Lycra every weekend to be able to do or enjoy our rides. They're an inclusive experience.
Yeah. So if anyone's out there thinking of going, there's still a couple of places on Steve's
team, isn't there?
I mean, we'll be following you around, which we're looking forward to. We've sort of made Steve promise to send us weekly updates and things.
Yeah.
So is there still room?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's still a few opportunities for people to get on board. They certainly need to move quick. And all they need to do is jump onto the Hands Group website, which is handsgroup.org.au. Look for Digital Live Ride Experience and they can sign up there. And they need to raise $5,000. They need to pay for their expenses. And that fundraising is non-negotiable because that's what brings about the change that we do in Thailand. We've got 47 kids at university now. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing to see the number of kids increase, but it just keeps putting up the money that we've got to raise each year, you know. So through Digital Live, we've had a great experience with them. Last year in 2018, Steve decided that he would support Hands Across the Water, and there was almost $30,000 that came from the two Digital Live conferences because Steve doesn't make money out of this. And he's a very humble guy, and people would think he's doing this, making a lot of money himself. Well, he doesn't make anything.
Yeah.
All the profits go to charity, and we're very fortunate that we've been the one that benefits. And Steve, he's got that long-term vision to support kids as well. So Steve hasn't said, I want to build something that has my name on it. He's about supporting the kids, and through his connection with digital and education, that's what the money's used for, is to support our kids through uni.
I know, he's very excited about the bike ride, and we've talked about it a number of times, and you can definitely see that you've had a major impact on Steve and Digital Live and all the people that have done Digital Live, which is amazing. I guess probably a couple of last questions just to finish off. In 2019, what is the most important leadership quality that leaders need to learn?
My career, my professional career is divided into two, really, one in the policing side and then one in the field where I work now. And in my later time, I've been influenced a lot by some remarkable women that I've worked with who have devoted their lives to those who are less fortunate. And I think one of the big things I take from them is humility. And I think it's about accepting a bit more blame and a little less credit.
So the real estate industry is constantly changing with disruption and technology and all that sort of thing. And often you talk about leading with innovation. So what is the key to leading with innovation to future-proof your business going into 2019?
Move fast and accept there'll be mistakes. When we deployed into Thailand, there was 450 forensic staff who came from 36 different countries. And there was no leadership structure in place. You don't have an international org chart. The reason the Australians held the leadership positions was because we moved first. I think if you wait until you've got all of the answers to all of the questions, someone will beat you to it. Since I started Hands, I was so naive to what I was doing. And some would say I remain so, but certainly clarity comes with action. The more you do, the clearer you'll become.
What do they say, that imperfect action beats perfect inaction or something like
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
I think that's good advice.
Yeah.
Peter Baines, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
To subscribe to the magazine, visit eliteagent.com.au/subscribe.